WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Want to give some love to all of our Crab Cake sponsors. The Maryland Crab Cake Tour, presented by the Maryland Lottery, gets back out onto the road beginning March 4. To honor my father's birthday on March 5th, we're going to be down at Mama's on the Half Shell in Canton, having a delicious crab cake, probably some oysters as well, and talking about the world and the city. This guy has moved on to the world and the city, and a longtime friend of Don Moeller, of course, in our Baltimore Positive conversations. Don, I like it better when Luke comes on and he's like in the bowels of Congress and there's activity outside and there's danger ahead. But we're getting the calm Luke today. We're getting long version Baltimore Sun via New York Times today, right?
There we go. I want to, as we welcome Luke Broadwater from the New York Times. Luke, I'm going to jump right in almost where Nestor started, and that is the pace. It is hard for me to keep up with what you are writing down there now. It is a mile a minute trying to cover the January 6th committee, the post-Trump era. I'm going to start with that.
Don't forget the plague. Throw the plague in there. The plague. The mask
what is the workload like at this point in time for reporters covering your beat?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tremendous workload. You know, over the last probably half a year to a year, the January 6th committee has become my primary assignment. So sometimes it feels like that's all I write about anymore. But there's just so much news coming out of the investigation that it's a like a fever pitch to stay on top of it. They're up to like 550 witnesses, more than that now. There's more than 100 subpoenas. So there's just constant activity, people coming in and out, who said what are they learning? There's legal fights, like there's almost two dozen lawsuits now that are ongoing as the committee tries to get all these documents about what Trump was doing and the various schemes and plans to try to overturn the election that were going on, which we're getting more and more details about. It's a constant grind. It really is a ton of work. And, you know, I've been writing for the magazine. I've been writing for the book review as well. So,
It's prolific. I actually said to my wife yesterday, I said, I don't know when the young man has time to come up for air or hug his kids or, you know, it's he's writing nonstop. Having said, and again, I want to say to our listeners, if you really do want the latest up-to-date information, you have to follow Luke Broadwater on Twitter. You have to follow his articles on the New York Times because it's breaking news all day long. Having said that, Luke, I'm always trying to prioritize the big story, not get lost in the weeds, the big story. And I know as a reporter, that's important to you. What are you prior to? I mean, we've got the Green Bay sweep. We've got the RNC. We've got Trump taking documents to Mar-a-Lago, some of which are classified. What are you prioritizing now for your readers? And what do you think is the most important story you're telling?
Yeah, I think that's an important point you raised. It's very easy to get caught up in the daily frenzy and all the witness names and who's coming in and out. And it actually can probably get really confusing to people. They're hearing so many names and so many different things. So it is, I think, really important as a journalist covering this to keep it focused on the major themes that we're learning. And I think the major themes that we're learning is just how serious the attempts to cast aside democracy were, and I'll break down a few of these. One is the plans to seize voting machines. And we had a pretty big front page story maybe a week ago about how seriously Trump took this and how he tried not one, not two, but three different agencies to try to get them to seize voting machines after he had lost the election on the idea that they could force a either hand recount of the paper ballots order a new election in those states. And so there was talk first of having the Justice Department do it, having the National Guard do it, having Homeland Security do it. And each attempt was getting shot down by different people. But if any one of those agencies had gone along with it, it could have been a very even scarier story.
Well, he managed to get the U.S. Postal Service to be dismantled before the election as well, right? And that's a, you know, that's a major right side issue, voting by mail, that many places across the country, not as familiar with it in Maryland, but screwing with the Postal Service previous to that, again, Luke, it becomes a gaslighting thing, right? We all watched January 6th. You've given us inside poker that you were in the building when all that happened. All the 4chan that was going on and all of these websites where all of this came together and all of the tweeting and bragging and selfieing and pictures and video and people holding phones up talking about overthrowing the government in 1776 and all of them being brought in, it really all does lead back to Pennsylvania Avenue that day and him sitting with his feet up on the desk watching it happen. Anything else is just, is he going to jail? Like, I'm going to probably ask, this is going to be the question of the week for me. Don has PR questions of the week about the Super Bowl halftime show. Is he going to jail? I mean, I'm wondering, having watched all of this, what will it take to make him guilty? Because he's pretty guilty.
Yeah. I mean, those are good questions. The, one thing the January 6th committee is doing is that when they're finished their investigation and they know they have to wrap it up before the midterm elections is they're accumulating evidence to try to make a criminal referral. And what that could be is now a legislative body of Congress has no power to charge anybody with a crime, but they have two former U.S. attorneys leading this investigation. They have more than a dozen federal prosecutors working on this investigation. So these are serious people who understand prosecutions, who understand the law, who are going through, and I don't know if the word is flip, but they're going through lower level people and they're getting them to testify about their bosses and their bosses' bosses. And if they can uncover substantial evidence of a crime, they will make a referral to the Justice Department, which will have to take it seriously because of who these people are, how serious their methods are, and they will provide all that evidence to the Justice Department. Then it would be up to Merrick Garland to actually charge the case. We know that the Justice Department is doing their own investigation. They're being very quiet about that. They're not, there's been very few leaks about it. So we don't actually know how far along they are. But there's been a lot of pressure on Merrick Garland to try to not just charge the low-level minions who walked in the Capitol that day or whatever, but to go up the food chain and start getting people who planned, plotted, organized, who set the wheels in motion that caused the attack on the Capitol. So, you know, the short answer is I don't know. We don't know. We can't predict the future. But there's going to be a lot of pressure on Merrick Garland to do something here as more and more comes out about what Donald Trump and his allies were doing. That said, I think there was a big concern in the Justice Department about charging a former president. They think it looks bad. They think the optics aren't good for the Democrats to come in and charge the Republicans or the Republicans to come in and charge the Democrats. That's typically not what we do in America.
Well, he's already impeached twice and it was laughed at by the other side of the aisle, yes. Literally, right?
Yeah, I mean, impeachment is typically the method for dealing with, a rogue officer of the government. But in this case, you know, because of the lockstep nature that the Republicans all marched in for the most part, with some few exceptions, he was impeached, but not convicted and can run again for office. So there is that concern as well.
Luke, let's go back to some of the deeds and maybe you can walk our listeners through from your perspective what the ramifications could have been. And I think you said something really important early on, and that is that I think people many times are on information overload about this. And what I mean is they've sort of gone off into their two camps. Those of us who believe there's nothing they can tell us. There's nothing anyone on that committee is going to tell me about Donald Trump. that I don't believe or I think I don't already know. Doesn't mean I'm not interested in it, but whatever they tell me, I'll believe it. You know, your friend Jeremy Peters just written a new book, Insurgency. There's nothing in Insurgency. And again, I can't wait to read Jeremy's book. I think he's a good writer. There's nothing he's going to tell me. It's going to surprise me. Same time, my Republican friends are going to all think this is a witch hunt. So we know that. So therefore, let's go back to the deeds. You talked about seizing the voting machines. What was the belief as you cover the story now coming out of the committee on the part of the Trump inner circle? What was then to happen once the machines were seized?
Well, there were a number of proposals. And just to back this up a little bit, when Trump is getting these pitches to seize voting machines, they're coming from very extreme fringe people, right, who have connected themselves to Rudy Giuliani and the Trump campaign because Trump so badly wants to cling to power. So he's looking for anything. And so the more responsible people in the White House, even people that I think liberals and Democrats hate, like people that they think is hard Republicans, right, hard right conservatives, they think these ideas are crazy. And so they're in the White House. Now, Mike Flynn, Sidney Powell, Patrick Byrne sort of come up with a plan that they've got to get these ideas to Trump to seize the voting machines. And they're going to get into the White House by hook or by crook, they say, even though Mark Meadows doesn't want them in, even though other people don't want them in. And so they arrange for this low-level aide to buzz them into the White House. They get close to the Oval Office. Trump sees them, waves them in. So they're now in the White House making this pitch about seizing the voting machines. They're in the Oval Office. The White House counsel's office hears about this. They come, you know, rushing into the meeting to try to shut it down. But Trump is into it. And so he starts asking, like, you know, hey, could we really do this? And let's call some people.
It's a good idea.
Yeah. And there are a couple of different options they give him. One is to have the National Guard roll into seven states, seize the machines, and start doing, the guard will then count the ballots themselves.
You know what's unbelievable is you couldn't get the National Guard to come in and keep people from urinating in Nancy Pelosi's office, right? Like right. The National Guard couldn't get called in for that, but they were plotting this. That's amazing.
And there actually may be some connection between those two things, which I'll get to in a minute. But the other option was, and this is what some people wanted, to have the military order a new election because Trump had lost. We're going to vote again until we get the result we want. And so and Trump kind of liked those ideas and wanted to check them out and said, Rudy, make some calls. You know, let's see if we can do this. And it was really hard right people inside the administration who were saying, we can't do this. And Rudy at one point said, if we go through with this, we're all going to jail. And so, you know,
I hope he's right.
Yeah. So they knew that. And eventually that idea does die. It does die, but it is connected in some ways to some of the other schemes. You've probably heard in the news about the fake electors, right?
Hold on, man. He was going to send planes out to blow up hurricanes. We were going to buy Greenland. I mean, there's nothing out of play if we could put ourselves back into where that was 2 years ago, right?
That becomes the point, right? And Luke, that's where you're going. Now, in the midst of all this, we now have Peter Navarro dreaming up, and Rudy, the Green Bay sweep, with images of Vince Lombardi, for those people that are on the front, we're going to run the Green Bay sweep. So talk about the Green Bay sweep, and that's swirling around at the same time.
Yeah, so Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro cook up this plan they call the Green Bay sweep, and in their view, Mike Pence is going to be the quarterback of the sweep.
Steve Bannon, by the way, who would be in jail if it weren't for Trump letting him out, kind of, sort of, right? Exactly?
He was pardoned, yeah. I mean, he defrauded Trump donors of millions of dollars, allegedly by the Justice Department, to build the wall when they just spent it on themselves.
That's the amazing part of me is the right-wing side of this is the people who should be in prison, that I would be in prison if I took my FCC license and went radio-free Havana at any point, right? Like, literally, these are the people broadcasting that I see on my Twitter feed still to this day that are leading the post-insurrection, right? These people are still out here. They're not hiding from what they did or what they're doing, literally, right?
So we've got Bannon not in jail. We've got Navarro and Rudy coming up with the Green Bay sweep, and Pence is going to be Bart Starr. Take us from there.
Yeah, and I'll just point out really quickly that Bannon is charged with two contempt of Congress counts that could be up to 2 years in jail. So right now, because of this investigation, there are criminal charges pending against him again. But so as part of the so-called Green Bay sweep, these alternate or fake electors from seven states will be sent to Congress. Then when the vote is called, Mike Pence, as the quarterback, will deny the legitimate votes of the voters, except the fake slates. And that will cause a vote of Congress to go into effect. And then the House of Representatives, who I guess is the wide receiver or the running back, now has the ball. And it will be Jim Jordan and the 100 or so Republicans of Congress who will take over, and they will vote in Trump. So he will stay in the Green Bay sweep despite losing the election. That was the plan. The problem was Mike Pence wouldn't go along with it. And they're still furious at Mike Pence to this day over it, that he and Mike Pence wanted to keep Trump president, like he did. And he was looking for a way to make it happen, but he was not willing to take this extraordinary step, which was to exploit what they found they thought was a loophole in the Electoral Count Act that would allow the vice president to unilaterally throw out votes.
You talk about a mafia move here, right? Hey, yeah. Dude, you're either going to do this and be in our jail, or you're going to spend the rest of your life being hunted down by the animals of my party, right? Like, literally, well, Pence is persona non grata now, right? Like, he's like Kinzinger and the former vice president's daughter, right? Like, they're not invited to the party anymore, right? They were disloyal to the dear leader, right?
Yeah, he's not getting to play golf at Mar-a-Lago. I think that's safe to say. But Nestor, listen to what else Luke said there. And Luke, I want you to expand upon it, because I think it gets lost in the shuffle. How close, and this is what comes through in your writing, how close we were. Democracy was on this cliff, tinkering back and forth, to the point where, as you said, Mike Pence obviously wanted Donald Trump to continue to be president, to the point where he, and I think you wrote about this at the time, it goes back, you know, over a year now, but he calls Dan Quayle, you know, the former vice president, in hopes that Dan Quayle is going to say, you know, Mike, I think you can do that. Had Dan Quayle said, I mean, my take, and you talk about this, Luke, had Dan Quayle said, you know what, Mike, the way I read the Constitution, I think you can do that. Of course, Quayle said, Mike, you can't do that. Mike, the Constitution is clear. But had Quayle said something else, we may have gotten a different result, right, Luke?
Yeah, I mean, Mike Pence, like, he checks it out. So he calls Quayle, he calls conservative legal experts, and almost all of them tell him, you cannot do that. That is illegal. You should not do that. It's unconstitutional.
Well, Rudy probably thought it was a great idea, right?
And so, yeah, I mean, Rudy was definitely into the whole fake electors scheme. But so, you know, if you talk to some of Pence's people, they said he never really took it seriously, but he does make several calls to check it out. And he's told pretty uniformly, do not do that. And so they actually keep their cards very close to the chest, because they don't want to start a big fight with Trump in these final days. And so Trump doesn't really know what Pence is going to do up until January 6th itself. Even that morning, he calls Pence and uses the P word with him on the phone. Either you're going to be or you're going to be with us. And Pence doesn't put out the statement saying he's going to certify the election until later in the day. So they're kept in the dark. And
there's a lot on Pence that day. And I don't know if the book will ever be written about how he just tried to stay alive, right? Like, literally, he literally was truly concerned and truly was in danger. That's not hyperbole, right, Luke?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, and you can see Trump egging it on. He's putting the pressure of the crowd on Pence. He's tweeting about Pence. And the crowd clearly got the message, because they're chanting, hang Mike Pence, right? And they're hunting for him in the halls, looking for him.
And so they got the galley set up.
There was even a gallows erected. I mean, it's
there. But you know, you just said something.
It's sickening just talking about it. I haven't talked about it in a while. It's sickening.
Well, I want to make sure that I heard what you said correctly, because it went by and we didn't pick up on it right away. I hadn't thought about it until you just said this. You said Mike Pence didn't put out a statement telegraphing what he was going to do until later. So, Luke, are you suggesting that there's some thought among some people that had the insurrection not taken place, that Pence was still on the fence? Or are you, as a reporter, based on who you've talked to, convinced that even without the insurrection, Pence was going to do the right thing that morning? Or do you think the insurrection changed his mind?
I think Pence and his team had their mind made up. They were not going to go along with this scheme. But they didn't want to tell Trump until it was unavoidable. Because who knows, maybe the mob would have attacked him before he even got to the Capitol that day. We don't know. So
think of that. Think of what you're saying there. Well, now you've got this specter, and you're covering it every day. Rudy, will he or won't he? You know, we're talking about a guy who holds a press conference at a landscaping company who has hair dye coming down his face. I don't know how we take him seriously, but what do your sources tell you, Luke, is the latest play by Rudy Giuliani saying that, yeah, I may come in there and talk to the committee? What's that all about?
Well, I think Rudy's in a tough financial situation, and it's expensive to fight a subpoena. So we know that he is in conversations with the committee that are ongoing about when or if he'll come in, how many documents he'll provide, how long he'll testify for, what questions he will or won't answer. He does have some legitimate defenses to answering questions, right? Attorney-client privilege is a real thing. The Fifth Amendment self-incrimination is a real thing. So he maybe can invoke some protections against testifying in some areas. But there'll be other areas that are open. I mean, you can't just wave a magic wand, as they say, over all these events and say, well, it's all protected by a client, attorney-client privilege, when a lot of this clearly wasn't. So a lot of the plotting and planning and who's meeting with whom and lots of documents that he has could very much be in play for the committee. And they are in conversations about when he will come in. And the committee fully expects him to eventually come in and testify.
Luke Broadwater is our guest. He is of the New York Times, but of Catonsville and of Baltimore and of the Baltimore Sun, formerly the Baltimore Sun, which a lot of folks go under the Baltimore banner. We'll be talking to Pam Wood and some other folks here getting into that. But right now we're on insurrection on January 6th. And look, it's amazing. We're half an hour into this and we're just literally scratching the surface. But my question would be about phones, communication, burner phones, evidence. What evidence could be brought forward in regard to emails, burner phone, you know, all of that feels like this isn't the old world where you get on a phone and as long as it's not tapped, you say whatever you say. Back in the, all of this was done out in the open. It was done on television. It was done on social media. It was done amongst thousands of people in various ways inside and outside of the Capitol. There was a rally out in front. There was a Supreme Court justice whose wife funded it. I mean, there's who put the money behind bringing these people here. And then there's the bombs at the DNC and I mean, this is a really deep day, and there's a whole faction of the country that just wants to blink and make it go away, and there's the rest of us that say, whoa, 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 I was awake that day. And then there's guys like you that were in the building and in peril that day that want someone to pay for the crimes. And I guess my question would be, where is the committee right now, and where's the end game over the next 90 days, and what have they still not learned? I mean, I'm just a citizen that watched it all happen, and I have a pretty strong sense of guilt. You know, just if I were on the jury right now, I've seen a lot of evidence, but I haven't seen the real evidence, which is text going back and forth, who signed into the White House, who didn't sign into the White House, what was said as the insurrection was going on, and there was no one there to save you and Nancy Pelosi and the kids that are interns hiding under the desks, all of these things that went on that day. Give me the next 90 days, the next 120 days as to what evidence, what your next story is going to be about 2 weeks from now.
Sure. Well, we don't know what we don't know in the future, but the I do agree that sort of the broad outlines of the conspiracy to overturn the election are known, right? But what we do, like every new piece of evidence that we're finding, all of them make it look worse and worse, right? There'll be just firmer and firmer details that
were very intentional, right? I mean, it was very, very orchestrated. This just wasn't a bunch of people showing up in DC.
And that's a good point. I think that maybe is the greatest broad takeaway, is that you might have watched January 6th from afar and thought, oh, a rally got out of hand, you know, and some people acted inappropriately. And to an extent, that is true. But why were they there? What were they? Who put them up to it? Who amassed
there were military teams leading military lines into the Capitol. There were broken windows that everybody knew were broken. There were buttons. There were emergency buttons disconnected. There was just all sorts of things happening here. This was an inside job.
Like, we haven't had it's pretty rare to have sedition, conspiracy to commit sedition charges in American history, and yet we have that in this case. That shows you how serious it is.
And go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I mean, more than 700 people have been arrested. But as for the committee's next 90 days, I think what we're going to start seeing is they have depositions scheduled through March right now. So it's probably going to be till maybe April, but we will start seeing public hearings. Well, they'll start bringing all their evidence forward and laying it out for the public. And that they hope will present such a damning account, perhaps in prime time, that it can finally break through some of the partisan divide here.
They're going to need to do that, right? This is going to be a made-for-TV OJ nighttime event. Otherwise, Fox will just go on talking about, you know, whatever bird goes down whatever hole that day, right? Literally.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible that even with primetime hearings, even with damning evidence, that it won't break through the partisan divide.
Well, the jury has to be as a country of the United States, literally, right, in the end.
Yeah. And that's going to be hard, because I doubt that Fox would carry the primetime hearings. They would probably show highlights, but I doubt that they're going to break into Hannity and Tucker and Laura and break up their shows to cover this. Luke, as a reporter, and Nestor always loves the journalism stuff. So now all of the visitor logs are being turned over. As a reporter, what will you be looking for in those visitor logs? What's your reporter gut tell you?
Well, we'll be looking for any names that seem unusual, or how often certain people that we know were pushing these plots and schemes were checking in to the White House. Also, I think it will be important to show what they don't show. Who wasn't coming in through the official means that we know talked to Trump or visited Trump? Who wasn't? How were these people getting in if they're not in the visitor logs? That's what we saw with the call logs when the committee got those. We know Trump was making calls during certain times that day, and they didn't show up in the call logs. So where are those calls? Was he using somebody else's phone? Was he using a cell phone we don't know about? Was something else happened? Were the records not taken down properly?
Wasn't Jordan on the phone with him on the floor in the insurrection? Weren't there people inside?
Jordan talks to him, by his own account, multiple times on January 6th. The only call we know that's in the call logs is one from that morning before the violence breaks out. So where are the other calls with Jordan? We don't know. So those are the kind of...
Hey, let me ask you that, Luke. Luke, that's a great question you just said. It sounds to me, I should know this, but I don't, so I'm guessing others don't. Trump have his own personal cell phone, right? He's calling people at 1 a.m, 2 a.m. Right. So if I'm Jim Jordan and I have my cell phone, if I call Trump on his cell, is that recorded anywhere as a call log, or is that just a private call and it's not recorded anywhere?
Verizon or whoever that phone is with should have it, unless there's some sort of burner phone situation. But the call logs that the committee got are the official White House phone. And Trump would sometimes tell his secretary or someone, get this person on the phone for me. But lots of times he's using his cell phone. And the committee does not have his cell yet. They don't have Jim Jordan's cell yet.
Chinese probably do.
I'm not sure. So, are they entitled to those cell phones, Luke?
Well, so they have issued subpoenas for dozens.
Well, Hillary Clinton couldn't have an email server, right?
No, but I want to focus on whether they're entitled to the cell phones.
They've issued subpoenas for dozens, potentially hundreds of private cell phones. So far, to my knowledge, Jim Jordan and Donald Trump are not among them. But they, most of the cell companies have been turning them over. There have been 18 lawsuits filed by people trying to block them. But for the most part, they're getting the records. There is a lot of trepidation on the committee about issuing a subpoena for a fellow member's cell records. So Congress is this place of tradition and precedent.
Kind of like the NFL not rolling over on Dan Snyder, kind of.
And this, right. And so they don't tend to go extremely hard on each other out of tradition, and also a fear that if the Republicans take power, they will do the same thing to the Democrats. So as of right now, there is no subpoena for Jim Jordan's personal cell phone.
Well, what's your next big story, Luke? What should people be looking? What are you working on right now that people should be tuned into as they watch the New York Times?
Sure. I mean, we're constantly digging into the various angles of this plot. One thing that I'm really interested in right now is the committee has been hearing from different witnesses about the National Guard delay, and they're hearing vastly different stories from people. And so I don't know if this will be a story or not, but I'm really trying to get to the bottom of who was telling the truth and who was lying there, because you have generals telling the exact opposite versions of events to this committee. And so I'm hopeful I can try to figure out who's the liar among these generals and why they were lying.
Figure out which way they voted. Luke Broadwater is here from the New York Times, formerly the Baltimore Sun and always a Baltimore. Dude, I owe you like two crab cakes at this point, right? I mean, we got to get you. I'm wearing my Fadley shirt here.
Let's go to Fadley's.
There we go, Fadley's.
Dude, we're
there
revving
we go.
Up the engines in March. Yeah. We're starting the Maryland Crab Cake Tour.
When do they open the Cadenzville location?
We're working on that. Don, any update?
Well, they've worked through some issues, some permit issues. And I think speaking to Damie as recently as a week or two ago, I think they hope to get moving pretty, pretty soon. Hey, Luke, we've asked everybody. It's generational. Like everybody else in America, I'm assuming you watched the Super Bowl, the halftime show. Luke Broadwater, a thumbs up or a thumbs down guy? Pretty divisive
two
issue.
Two thumbs up. It was like, that was like the soundtrack coming from my Walkman in high school. So yeah,
that
was...
young guys with your rap music and all of that, you know. So I loved it.
Yeah, it was great.
Hey, Luke, we appreciate you. All of it brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. We're going to get the Crab Cake Tour back out. We're going to be at Mama's on the Half Shell in Canton beginning on March 4th. And we're going to Fadley's and we're going to Costas. We're doing that all in the month of March. I'll be giving the whole schedule out later on. And then you can come and have two crab cakes. And you can have the delicious mac and cheese with us in a bowl of crab soup if you wish, Luke. How about that?
Sounds good.
We got to feed you. You're working too hard down there. Appreciate you. And I do feel good that at least we got you from looks like your home office and not down in D.C. because I know the traffic up and down. But enjoy a little time at home. We always love having you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Keep up the great work, Luke.
Luke Broadwater, award-winning journalist, the real journalist, not the toy department that I worked in the sports department. We appreciate him coming on. Of course, Don Mueller doing all things Baltimore Positive here this week. I am back from the Super Bowl. It was a heck of a week out in L.A. If you've missed any of the stuff, the great interviews we've done with Ron Jaworski and Lee Steinberg and Warren Moon, a whole bunch of people, it's all up at BaltimorePositive.com.